Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
New information on Gabby Petito's death and a largely unnoticed sentence from the coroner in his news conference that may very well be revealing. I'm Shepard Smith. This is the news on CNBC.
Gabby Petito's gruesome final moments revealed.
The cause, death by strangulation, and manner is homicide.
What the coroner said about how she died and what he would not say. A star NFL coach resigns, out after a bombshell report of his racist, homophobic, and misogynistic communications. Details from John Gruden's emails.
Climb immediately. Climb the airplane.
The last radio call before a plane crashes into homes.
Go!
And bursts into flames.
Is anybody inside?
Plus, the hero neighbors saving lives caught on tape. A sharp reversal on how to prevent heart attacks and strokes. The new warning from a panel of experts. Why aspirin is not for everyone. The Virginia governor's race down to the wire. Combating severe teacher shortages. And a child abduction stopped by Good Samaritans.
Live from CNBC. The facts. The truth. The news with Shepard Smith.
Good evening. Gabby Petito died by strangulation. That finding announced by the Teton County coroner in Wyoming today. He'd already ruled her death a homicide. According to the document the coroner filed on cause of death, it was manual strangulation, meaning the killer used their hands to do it. The 22-year-old left on a cross-country road trip with her boyfriend, Brian Laundrie, back in July. A month and a half ago, he returned alone and is now wanted by the FBI for credit card fraud. Authorities have not named him a suspect in her murder. The coroner also revealing today that he thinks Gabby died 3 to 4 weeks before the search crews found her body. That discovery September 19th in this camping area near Jackson, Wyoming. Which means the coroner estimates Gabby died sometime between August 22nd and August 29th. Now, according to events reported by law enforcement, the timeline gets a little more narrow. Because a witness spotted Gabby and Brian at a Mexican restaurant in Jackson, Wyoming on August 27th. Later that same day, between 6 and 6:30 p.m., somebody reported spotting their van near the campsite where searchers found Gabby's body. Then 5 days later, September the 1st, 10:26 a.m., police say the van, presumably driven by Brian, enters Northport, Florida. So based on that timeline and the new information from the coroner, Gabby Petito likely died sometime between the evening of August the 27th and the afternoon of August 30th. We'll break down more of what the coroner had to say in just a moment with a forensic pathologist, including what could be a revealing clue. But first, CNBC's Valerie Castro is here with us. The coroner seemed to reveal this other important nugget.
And, Chip, the coroner couldn't say very much to begin with today, but he did say that under Wyoming state law, he couldn't comment on any specifics in the autopsy report besides the cause and manner of death. But what he did say may give us some insight into what else he knows and has seen during the course of this investigation. He answered some general questions and was asked what it's been like for his small office to handle such a high-profile case that has gotten national, if not international, attention. This is what he said.
Quite the media circus and continues to be. Unfortunately, this is only one of many deaths around the country of people who are involved in domestic violence.
People who are involved in domestic violence. Those are the words that he used, seeming to connect Gabby's death to a relationship that involved domestic violence, something no other official involved in this case has stated. You might remember when Gabby and Brian were pulled over in Utah by police, and that was all captured on body camera video. At that time, those officers made the call that Brian was the victim of a domestic incident with Gabby. Brian Laundrie has not been named a murder suspect in this case, and no arrest warrant on any charges related to violent crime has been issued for him, only a warrant for fraudulent use of a credit card. The Laundrie family did release a statement through their attorney following the coroner's press conference today that says Gabby Petito's death at such a young age is a tragedy. While Brian Laundrie is currently charged with the unauthorized use of a debit card belonging to Gabby, Brian is only considered a person of interest in relation to Gabby Petito's demise. At this time, Brian is still missing, and when he is located, we will address the pending fraud charge against him. The Petito family says they will not be releasing any statement until her body is brought home. Her remains were still with the coroner's office while the autopsy was being conducted over the last several weeks.
All right, Valerie, at least we have that new bit. Thanks so much. Dr. Priya Banerjee now, board-certified anatomic and forensic pathologist. Doctor, it's good of you to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
First off, if the coroner or the medical examiner had found DNA from someone other than her domestic partner, that person would already know it by now, though probably wouldn't be able to tell us. Or if that person had found DNA around her throat from someone other than Brian Laundrie, they would likely know it, but wouldn't be able to tell us, right?
Yes, I don't think they would be able to tell us right now.
Yeah, but they would know it. If they had DNA that excluded Brian Laundrie, they would know that. Whether they want it released or not is another matter.
I think that's correct.
So, which leads me to this statement again. Listen again.
Unfortunately, this is only one of many deaths around the country of people who are involved in domestic violence.
People who are involved in domestic violence. Again, this is new today. Domestic violence, if they had found DNA from Brian Laundrie under the fingernails or DNA from Brian Laundrie around her neck, that wouldn't necessarily mean in and of itself that he was the killer. After all, they were domestic partners, for lack of a better phrase.
Exactly. I think that's a critical point. They're connected and his DNA is not foreign to her.
Right. But if you were to find only one person's DNA anywhere on her body, then to go forward and say, well, you know, someone involved with domestic violence, from the perspective of the medical examiner, that might make plenty of sense.
Yes. Yes, I think so. You know, in context of finding someone's DNA and the injuries, that makes it together a much more stronger link to her death.
Yeah. And we're not drawing conclusions here. We're listening to what we heard and trying to figure out if he's telling us something. Then there's the matter of manual strangulation, according to the coroner. Why would that detail, manual strangulation, be important?
You know, I think it's important to know that, first of all, they were able to tell that she still had significant internal injuries despite having decomposed. The body's not in the normal state, you know, after 3 to 4 weeks. So that's really critical. And then to think, you know, manual strangulation is done with the hands. You know, or a body part for that matter, you don't need anything outside of that.
And I've heard medical examiners call manual strangulation of that kind a very personal, I've heard many use the word intimate way to kill people.
Exactly. You took the words out of my mouth. I was going to say up close and personal. It's a lot of anger and it's very targeted towards the victim.
Dr. Banerjee, I can't thank you enough. Hope you'll join us again. We have new details today of the plane crash that killed two people in Santee, California yesterday, and words of heroic rescues. Air traffic audio reveals that moments before that crash, a controller urgently warned the pilot, "You're flying too low." Listen.
Okay, it looks like you're descending, sir. I need to make sure you are climbing, not descending. Go to the pilot. Air 22 Golf, stay altitude. 2500 to the Golf. Air 22 Golf, low altitude alert. Climb immediately. Climb the airplane. Maintain 5,000. Expedite climb. Climb the airplane, please.
Instead, he crashed. Thankfully, immediately after it, neighbors came running to the rescue. They pulled one woman out of a window of a burning home, her hair and face singed. They knocked down fencing to rescue another man in the backyard of that same house. New video also shows the precipitous and terrifying nosedive the plane took. Look here. You'll see it. See there in the corner? Small plane plunging to the ground, then the explosion on impact. And from this other angle, a sharp downward turn and the destruction. NBC's Emily Ikeda is live for us in Santee, California. Emily, what do we know about the pilot?
Hey there, Shep. So just new details coming in tonight. We're learning the pilot was the only person on board during the fiery crash leading to the apocalyptic scene you're seeing behind me. Dr. Sugata Das owned the twin-engine Cessna plane and was behind the controls during his trip yesterday to San Diego. Nearby residents say they heard a sputtering sound as the small plane dove into the neighborhood. Witnesses describe seeing the wing of the plane clip a UPS truck before launching forward into several homes. Inside one of those homes, a senior couple. Quick-thinking neighbors rushed to their aid, pulling the woman from the window and her husband through a broken fence. They're now in the hospital with burns, but they're alive, and for that, their son is grateful. Listen here.
It's amazing, you know, and I can't imagine what I would do in that situation. Obviously, you know, I'd like to think that I would jump into that burning building, but for them to actually, you know, pull her out and keep her safe and you know, help Phil get through that fence. It's awe-inspiring.
And a second person was killed on the ground, a UPS driver named Steve Kruger. I actually just spoke with his brother, who described him as fun-loving, hard-working, and just a really positive attitude. In terms of what's next, well, you're seeing some of it play out behind me, the cleanup process. The NTSB is leading the investigation, which could be a lengthy one. We're looking at 1 to 2 years, but we likely will see a preliminary report in the next 2 weeks. And, Shep, this is the third deadly plane crash here in Santee in the last 6 years.
Emily Ikeda, thank you. More apparent Havana syndrome attacks. There's word the U.S. Embassy in Colombia is investigating several cases of Havana syndrome just days before the Secretary of State Anthony Blinken is set to visit. Wall Street Journal reports at least one family had to fly out of the country for treatment. Concerns have grown more serious in recent days. Havana syndrome is the mysterious, unexplained condition believed to be directed energy striking American diplomats and intelligence officers and government workers all around the world. Victims have reported hearing a loud grinding noise, followed by headaches, vertigo, even brain damage. This would be the second time that we know of that Havana syndrome cases have coincided with an upcoming visit by a top U.S. official. Vice President Harris delayed for several hours her trip to Vietnam in August after two U.S. diplomats in Hanoi reported symptoms of Havana syndrome. NBC News has reported the U.S. suspects Russia might be using microwave devices to attack or spy on Americans overseas. The Kremlin has denied any involvement. Democrats are very concerned in Virginia. It's having the first big statewide election in America since the 2020 election. That's in 3 weeks. Now, the Dems are bringing in some big name help. The most recent polls show an incredibly tight race for governor. A vaccine face-off. The White House pushing for mandates. The Texas governor banning all mandates. How businesses stuck in the middle are pushing back. And a young child ripped from the arms of her own grandmother in broad daylight. The Good Samaritan, who jumps in and saves the day.
Shining through CIDP to me means being able to do what you want to do and not what the disease is telling you you can't do. Don't give in to the disease. It's not easy, but I'm going to do it. And like I've told people, I may have CIDP, but CIDP don't have me.
Sign up at shiningthroughcidp.com to get real CIDP stories and resources.
The South Dakota Stories, Volume 7. My trip to South Dakota was the best summer ever. Now I don't need to go to Mars, because I've been to the Badlands. And I caught a bigger walleye than Dad when we went to the Missouri River. Then I rode my bike through these huge rocks called Needles. Ooh, I also saw my first herd of bison, even a fuzzy furry baby one. I can't wait to go back and see more. There's so much South Dakota, so little time.
Democrats are strong lately in Virginia, but the race for governor there is getting tighter and tighter. And now former President Obama is set to hit the campaign trail to try to help out former Governor Terry McAuliffe. He announced on Morning Joe today that Mr. Obama will headline his rally in Richmond next Saturday.
The stakes are so huge. And if people don't understand, you know, they come out in presidential years, but they have to come out in this off year. If I were not to win this, this would be, as I say, the comeback of Donald Trump. This would lift him off the mat. He would use this the launch pad to campaign in 2022 and then set him up for 2024.
You see what they're doing here. With President Biden's popularity sagging and infrastructure stalled, Virginia's gubernatorial election could prove to be a bellwether in what's to come in next year's midterms. Then control of Congress is up for grabs. CNBC senior White House correspondent Kayla Tausche is live in Arlington, Virginia. Kayla?
Shep, early voting is already underway here in Virginia in the race between former Governor Terry McAuliffe and former private equity executive Glenn Youngkin. It's a familiar plot. Longtime Democratic politician versus Republican businessman and political outsider. And it's a microcosm of how voters feel on national issues and potentially foreshadowing turnout next year, according to Larry Sabato at UVA's Center for Politics.
If the Republican wins, it's going to partly be because Biden was unpopular and because the Democrats in Congress could not get their act together and deliver on their promises. How does that affect the electorate? It means that Democrats are depressed and less willing to work. They're less enthusiastic. They're unlikely to turn out in the usual numbers to vote.
McAuliffe has big ticket billing here in the home stretch. First Lady Jill Biden on Friday and President Obama in Richmond a week from Saturday. But those deep ties to the Democratic Party are a double-edged sword. As President Biden's approval steadily dipped below 50%, Republican Youngkin's popularity rose 9 points. Now the two candidates are nearly tied. The Real Clear Politics average of polls shows just 3.5 points between them, smaller than most polls' margins of error. GOP support in Virginia suburbs had been declining during Trump's presidency, so Youngkin was walking a tightrope to woo both moderate and MAGA voters alike. But not all voters we talked to were sold.
I go Democrat because I'm not happy with what the Republicans are doing right now. Everybody's just sticking with something. They're not sticking with what the policy is. So I just decided I'm going to stick with Democrats so that we can go ahead and get this thing done.
President Trump has endorsed Youngkin 3 times, but said recently, if Youngkin wants to win, he needs to fully embrace the MAGA movement. Shep?
Kayla, thank you. The White House is pushing back on a Texas ban on vaccine mandates. The Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed an executive order just yesterday blocking any entity from mandating vaccines. That means private businesses can't require their workers and customers to be vaccinated. The White House calling the move political.
I think it's pretty clear when you make a choice that's against all public health information and data out there, that it's not based on what is in the interest of the people you are governing. It's perhaps in the interest of your own politics.
President Biden has been pushing businesses across the country to require vaccinations for workers. Governor Abbott in Texas accused the administration of bullying private companies into those mandates. CNBC's Seema Modi is here. Seema, what happens now?
Shep, the focus now turns to the major corporations that are based in Texas, like Oracle and Dell, that are headquartered in Texas, to see what they will do next. Now, despite the governor's ruling, both American Airlines and Southwest say they will continue to request their employees to be vaccinated. American Air spokesperson says, quote, "We believe the federal vaccine mandate supersedes any conflicting state laws, and this does not change anything for American." Now, experts say businesses could pursue legal action. In Florida, where vaccine mandates are also banned, Norwegian Cruise Line CEO Frank Del Rio launched a lawsuit against the state in July. The legal fight put Del Rio against Governor Ron DeSantis, a rising Republican star. Del Rio's argument? It's not safe to cruise without requiring all crew and passengers to be vaccinated. A federal judge bought it and granted the cruise line a preliminary court injunction.
We felt a sincere obligation to protect our guests, our crew, the communities we visit. We're in the hospitality business. That's job one, to keep everyone safe.
Florida is challenging the decision. Now, Norwegian is not the only business to take action in the wake of new legislation. Following the passage of a new abortion law in Texas, ride-hailing apps Uber and Lyft said drivers' legal fees would be covered if they were sued for driving a woman to an abortion clinic. There was a time when CEOs shied away from politics, but with society becoming more politically charged, companies are increasingly taking a stand on certain issues, especially when it impacts their employees and customers.
Yep, when the businesses get involved, it seems to make changes. Seema, thanks very much. You know, the White House is pushing back the Maryland couple that is accused of trying to sell nuclear submarine secrets appearing in court for the first time now. A federal judge ordering Jonathan and Diana Toby to stay in jail at least until their next hearing on Friday. The court asked neither defendant to enter a plea. Prosecutors say the Tobys are a flight risk because they're facing life in prison. They're asking the judge to keep the couple locked up as they wait for trial. Investigators say now former U.S. Navy engineer and his wife thought they were selling closely guarded submarine propulsion technology to a foreign country. But the buyer was actually an undercover FBI agent. According to the feds, the couple had memory cards in both a peanut butter sandwich and a pack of chewing gum, and that they dropped them off in various locations. A man in New York City tried to kidnap a three-year-old in broad daylight, according to police, and surveillance cameras caught it on video. Look here. Witnesses say a grandmother is walking with the three kids in the Bronx. It shows a man scoop up the little girl and bolt away. The grandma tries to chase him while two young boys stay behind. You can see they're upset. People nearby join in the chase moments later, according to police. That part's off camera. They say that's when the man lets the girl go. Police say he takes off on a scooter, but they later find him and arrest him. Last night, the suspect smiled as cops walked him out of a station house in handcuffs. He's facing a long list of charges, including kidnapping, attempted kidnapping, unlawful imprisonment, and child endangerment. Tonight, our Lost Workers series goes into the classroom, where there's a major teacher shortage across America. Some cities are recruiting from abroad, even changing requirements to lure in new teachers. The efforts to keep school in session and why so many of those giving learning are leaving. Plus, at-home COVID testing. Should be a piece of cake by now, right? But good luck finding a kit in many parts of America or affording one if you do. Why at-home testing is such a pain in the nose and neck.
Shining through CIDP to me means being able to do what you want to do and not what the disease is telling you you can't do. Don't give in to the disease. It's not easy, but I'm going to do it. And like I've told people, I may have CIDP, but CIDP don't have me.
Sign up at shiningthroughcidp.com to get real CIDP stories and resources.
The worker crisis in America, it's getting worse. According to brand new data from the Labor Department, more than 4 million people quit their jobs in August. That's the most ever reported in nearly two decades of tracking. Tonight in our series, The Lost Workers, we focus on the teacher shortage. The government reports more than 430,000 education jobs were still open as of August. That includes public and private schools. In Chicago, the school staff shortage is so bad that officials there nearly canceled classes this month. In Polk County, Florida, near Tampa, the school district hired about 70 teachers from around the world to fill open positions. And in Oregon, the state temporarily dropped the college degree requirement to become a substitute teacher. Like many worker shortages, this one also has ties to COVID. Just today in Boston, the mayor announced nearly 10% of public school employees could be suspended without pay if they don't show proof of vaccination or a weekly COVID test. In other schools across the country, working during a pandemic became just too much for many educators. Here's CNBC's Kate Rogers.
Back in the classroom after months of virtual learning, where controversy continues to swirl over vaccines and masks, the nation's teachers are burnt out.
They may not have the energy to continue to move forward. And so there will be folks who will eventually maybe decide to leave.
Many teachers worried for themselves and their students.
With every good teacher we've lost, that leaves us with one less person willing to struggle through reading and math with your child.
Some are leaving the profession altogether as the stress takes its toll. Data from the American Federation of Teachers and RAND show nearly one in four teachers said they were likely to leave their jobs by the end of the 2020-2021 school year. That number was one in six pre-pandemic. Nearly 80% reported feeling job-related stress. David Fishkind is one of the teachers who retired early. As a cancer survivor, he was frustrated over his Florida school's handling of COVID case disclosures and a lack of accommodations to teach remotely.
And I felt for the students. I didn't want the students to be endangered. I didn't want the staff to be endangered. I didn't want my family to be endangered by this pandemic, which by this point, it killed almost 500,000 people.
Part of the problem is that employment hasn't kept up with enrollment. Data from the Economic Policy Institute show that over the last decade, there's a shortfall of nearly 600,000 public education employees needed to serve students. In Washington, the Biden administration is hoping to help fill the gap.
As a country, we need to do better respecting the profession and honoring our educators. And that starts by making sure that they have a livable wage. In many parts of our country, they must have more than one job to make ends meet. That's unacceptable.
Another challenge here, vaccines. Recent AFT data show 2/3 of K-12 members favor a requirement unless employees have a valid medical or religious exemption. More than half, but certainly not a home run, Chip.
Kate, thank you. To hear more about the pandemic's impact on our schools and the state of financial education, tune in tomorrow to our Invest in Your Digital Town Hall with Education Secretary Miguel Cardona. CNBC's Sharon Epperson hosts, beginning at 1 o'clock Eastern Time at CNBC.com. A lesson in mental health today for students at the University of North Carolina following two suicide investigations. The call for help, how the school responded, and why many students and parents say it's not enough. John Gruden steps down as the head coach of the Raiders after his emails with racist and homophobic remarks came out. The emails part of a larger investigation, and there are hundreds of thousands more. What it could all mean as we approach the bottom of the hour and the top of the news from CNBC. One company paying dearly for the Chevy Bolt car recall? That's what's topping CNBC on the money. The battery manufacturer LG Chemicals agreeing to reimburse General Motors up to nearly $2 billion. The reason? To cover the cost of recalling the Chevy Bolt electric vehicles over fire risks caused by its faulty batteries. That money will cover most of the cost of fixing the cars, they tell us, including replacing some of those batteries. All Amazon corporate workers won't have to go back to work at the office in January as previously planned. Now the company reports it'll allow individual teams to decide which policy works best for them. Some may go back full-time, some may be remote only, many may be hybrid. And Heinz, capitalizing on ketchups used as a costume prop for Halloween. The company rolling out this special edition Heinz tomato blood ketchup and costume kit. It's still just regular ketchup, just with special packaging. And a new tagline, if you have Heinz, you have a costume. On Wall Street, the Dow down 118, S&P down 11, NASDAQ down 20. I'm Shepard Smith on CNBC. It's the bottom of the hour. Time for the top of the news.
Aspirin no longer recommended for all older adults after years of it being pushed to help prevent heart disease. Climate disasters are becoming much more costly. The extraordinary number of billion-dollar damage events to hit America this year. But first, NFL controversy. One of the league's highest paid and highest profile coaches resigns.
John Gruden out as head coach of the Las Vegas Raiders. His resignation after more emails surfaced just last night. These show he made crude and abhorrent comments over several years about women, gays, and people of color. At the time he wrote the emails, Gruden was working as an analyst for ESPN. The New York Times reported last night the emails show Gruden called NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell a derogatory term for a gay person and a clueless anti-football P-word. Gruden also reportedly wrote that Goodell should not have pressured a coach to draft queers. In his resignation statement, Gruden wrote, "I love the Raiders and do not want to be a distraction. I'm sorry. I never meant to hurt anyone." After the Raiders game on Sunday, a reporter asked then-coach about the racist comment he made years ago, and he asked if he'd made any similar disparaging remarks. Here's how Gruden responded.
All I can say is I'm not a racist. I can't remember a lot of the things that transpired 10 or 12 years ago, but I stand here in front of everybody apologizing. I know I'm not, I don't have an ounce of racism in me.
24 hours later, he was out of a job. Here's CNBC's Perry Russum.
John Gruden's tenure as Las Vegas Raiders head coach came to a crashing end Monday night.
Breaking news tonight, John Gruden out as Las Vegas Raiders head coach.
The resignation comes shortly after the New York Times reported that over the course of several years, Gruden sent emails where he criticized women becoming referees, the drafting of an openly gay player, and used a homophobic slur while referring to NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell. In a statement, a spokesperson for the NFL called Gruden's actions appalling, abhorrent, and wholly contrary to the NFL's values. The story started Friday night when the Wall Street Journal reported that back in 2011, Gruden used racist language while describing NFL union chief D'Amar Smith, writing, "D'Amar Smith has lips the size of Michelin tires." But Gruden remained on the sidelines, coaching the team on Sunday, speaking to reporters Monday morning.
I feel very good about the things I have learned. I also feel really good about what I stand for.
The emails, confirmed by the NFL but not seen by CNBC, were uncovered during a workplace misconduct investigation into the Washington football team.
John Gruden's collateral damage in this case. His career is ruined. You might not say that that's collateral damage, but he wasn't even the reason why this investigation took place.
Gruden was introduced as Raiders head coach in 2018, signing a 10-year, $100 million contract, the largest in NFL history.
It is the biggest day of my life right now to have him here to run this organization.
Keyshawn Johnson played for Gruden for 2 years and says the coach's public comments were different behind closed doors.
It's the talking behind people's back.
Yeah,
that was one of his traits in Tampa.
And Gruden won a Super Bowl in Tampa Bay. Tonight we found out he is going to be removed from that team's ring of honor. Rich Bisaccia will be taking over for Gruden in Vegas on an interim basis. He was their special teams and assistant head coach. A lot of questions still have to be answered by both team ownership and the NFL, Shep.
Perry Russum live in our Boston newsroom tonight. Sports reporter J.A. Donde now, director of sports journalism at Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism. J.A., thanks a lot. NFL reportedly sitting on more than 650,000 emails from the investigation into the Washington football team. There's a lot of pressure on this league to release more of them. Where do you see this going?
Exactly. And this is a byproduct of that investigation, this whole John Gruden story. And I think there was a miscalculation by the NFL with the belief that this could be isolated to John Gruden. This could be defined as a John Gruden problem and not an NFL problem or not a Washington football program. And instead, it's galvanized both some of the women who were the impetus behind the investigation of the Washington football team for their mistreatment while they're employed there, and the NFL Players Association, which is now calling for a more full release of the entirety of those 650,000 emails. So it's very purposeful that we've only heard a select few emails so far. What else is in there? Why is Daniel Snyder, whose ownership of the team caused this investigation to be launched in the first place, why is he still associated, and why does he still have a place for him in the NFL if there's not a place for the John Grudens in the NFL?
J.A., does this to you speak more broadly of the culture in the NFL, or is that a stretch we shouldn't make?
Well, I think it's fair to make that because John Gruden was so intertwined with the NFL. There are a few more faces that we associate with the league. He's got to be in the top 10. You know, you can start with Tom Brady and Bill Belichick, Patrick Mahomes, maybe Peyton Manning, but there's not too many more faces and identities that I would associate with the league more than John Gruden. The fact that he was making these comments to a team president in the league, the fact that we haven't seen NFL owners jump up and say, this does not represent who we are at all. The fact that there has not been a greater call within the NFL ownership circles to shed more light on this, as if there was fear as what would come to light if we were to investigate this further. Mm-hmm. All of that is indicative of how pervasive this attitude very well could be within the league.
J.A. Adonde, thank you. Okay, picture this. You wake up with a runny nose and a scratchy throat. You immediately go, oh, is it COVID? Then you head down to your local pharmacy to grab a quick and easy rapid test, but come up empty. Nothing there. You bounce from store to store searching for an at-home test, but can't find a single one. For a lot of Americans, that's how it goes. Rapid tests like these are widely available in other countries. They're free in a lot of places, including the UK and France and Germany, but not so much in the United States, at least not yet. CNBC's Meg Terrell covers science and health for us. Why can it be so hard to find one of these things?
Yeah, Chef, experts point to a couple reasons, chiefly that the U.S. didn't prioritize having ubiquitous, inexpensive home tests earlier on. The FDA has now cleared 7 so-called antigen tests for home use that are available without a prescription, all since December. These are tests like Abbott's Binax Now, Quidel's QuickView, and OraSure's IntelliSwab. You can find these at stores like Walmart, CVS, and Walgreens, except a lot of times you'll check and they'll be sold out. That's at least partly because earlier this year, manufacturers cut back on making these tests, or at least in one case, even reportedly destroyed inventory as more people got vaccinated. And the CDC said fully vaccinated people didn't need to be tested after exposure if they were showing no symptoms. That guidance, of course, changed along with the agency's mask guidance in July with the Delta variant. Now the U.S. is ramping up supply of these tests, with the White House last week pledging another $1 billion to the effort and promising to quadruple the number of at-home tests available to Americans by December to 200 million per month. Now, some advocates say that's still not enough and that they're still too pricey at around $10 per test. But other health experts caution these tests aren't perfect, so they should be confirmed if you get a negative result, but you think you might have COVID.
Meg, we got some news on booster shots today.
We did. Ahead of a 2-day meeting on boosters for Moderna and J&J later this week, the companies today laid out their cases in briefing documents. Moderna applied for a half-dose booster, which it says still increases the immune response while potentially carrying fewer side effects and increasing global vaccine supply. J&J says a boost to its single shot at 2 months can increase efficacy up to 94%, but it says spacing it out to 6 months could be even better. Now, the FDA didn't weigh in today other than saying all available vaccines in the U.S. still provide strong protection against severe disease. But experts expect they're likely to follow suit with what they did for Pfizer and potentially green light boosters for certain groups who got Moderna and J&J within a week or so.
Good Chef. News. Meg, thank you. Suicide. It's now the second leading cause of death in the U.S. among people 15 to 34 years old. That's the word from the CDC. Suicide and mental health issues are both major concerns nationwide, but experts say college students are at particular risk. At the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, the chancellor says the school's facing a mental health crisis. He canceled classes for today, gave students what he called a wellness day, and local officials investigate an on-campus suicide on Saturday and what they believe was an attempted suicide on Sunday. Some students want more. They're holding a demonstration tomorrow, and parents a protest on Thursday. Here's NBC's Issa Gutierrez.
Hey, Shep. Students here on campus tell me that they're overwhelmed and that they're feeling exhausted, not just with school and a global pandemic, but now most recently dealing with the deaths of their peers. Now, over the weekend, the student government sent a letter to university leaders asking them for 2 mental health days to be able to grieve and process what's been going on campus. The school only canceled classes today, and students are saying that's just not enough.
I would like to see UNC put a lot more money into CAPS, which is the counseling resource that we have on campus for people who can go to therapy or just talk about their mental health.
In a statement from the university's chancellor, we also heard that the school plans on starting some new mental health support networks for students and faculty. They will also be holding a mental health forum later this month. I spoke with mental health experts as well, who told me that they had been concerned about the mental wellness of students in this particular age group far before the pandemic.
They've had a loss of so many different things and so many different milestones and events. And then we put in the pressure of academically achieving, being away from home and support systems. And we're really just compounding those stressors right now.
Some of the things that Dr. Dave said community members can look out for are changes in behavior, changes in students eating, sleeping, the way and how often they're communicating with their family and friends. And then finally, of course, she said to take it seriously when college students and young adults in general say that they need help or that they're in a dark place. Shep.
Issa, thank you. If you or somebody you know are in crisis, please call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline at 1-800-273-8255. A multi-billion dollar price tag. Natural disasters, extreme weather costing America more than ever. And wait till you hear the danger that it poses to key national infrastructure. The La Palma volcano just won't quit. the lava now threatening more homes. New satellite images show the breathtaking extent of the damage. This year is set to be one of the costliest for natural disasters on record. That's according to a new report from NOAA. But here's the headline. In the first 9 months of this year, America was hit with 18 weather and climate-related disasters with a damage total of more than $1 billion each. That includes hurricanes, heat waves, wildfires, and tornadoes. In total, NOAA estimates the destruction from extreme weather has cost about $105 billion this year, compared to the 2020 full year, an estimated cost of about $100 billion. Now scientists warn these natural disasters could push the nation's infrastructure to the brink. On the cost of climate change, here's CNBC's Diana Olick.
Hurricane Ida brought record rainfall and flash flooding to the Northeast, and it also set a record as the costliest natural disaster of this year and one of the top five costliest hurricanes ever. So far, NOAA has its cost at just over $60 billion, but that's expected to rise in the final tally. While there were four more natural disasters last year, this year's caused twice the number of fatalities. That's drought, floods, severe storms, and wildfires that so far have burned more than 6 million acres, mostly across California and Colorado. And they're still burning, with the Alisal fire in Santa Barbara swelling to 6,000 acres today and zero containment. There was also one severe cold wave early this year in Texas that shut down the electrical grid.
We have more people and assets living in harm's way, so an increased exposure. We also have increased vulnerability, where we build, how we build. And of course, climate change is influencing and sometimes enhancing a lot of these extremes, making them longer in duration and tighter frequency and potentially more intense as well.
As the number and costs of natural disasters rise, so too does the risk to the nation's infrastructure. Utilities, ports, airports, and emergency services like police, fire, and hospitals. Already, one quarter of all critical infrastructure in the country is at risk of becoming inoperable today, according to a new report from First Street. That represents about 36,000 facilities. 23% of all road segments, or nearly 2 million miles of road, are at risk of becoming impassable.
And that doesn't even account for commercial and residential properties. A $1 trillion infrastructure package aimed at making the nation more resilient to climate disasters is still making its way through Congress. It even includes funding for the relocation of entire communities to get them out of harm's way. Now, the full NOAA report will be released tomorrow. Shep?
Diana, thank you. Mother Nature leaving her mark everywhere as we go round the world on CNBC. China, at least 28 people killed and more than 120,000 relocated after flooding in the northern province of Shaanxi. Authorities say 13 of those people died after a commuter bus plunged into a river just yesterday. This is the second major flood to hit China this year. Greece, an earthquake rocking the island of Crete this morning. The 6.4 magnitude caused items to fly off shelves and people to run for the streets in the popular tourist destination. Thousands left their homes, but no deaths or injuries reported. This is the second powerful quake to hit the island of Crete in the past 15 days. The first killed one person and left extensive damage. Spain. Stunning new images showing the lava from the volcano on La Palma in the Canary Islands. More than 700 residents ordered to abandon their homes today as more neighborhoods are threatened. Streams of lava have engulfed more buildings. Would you look at this? That's including a cement plant hit just yesterday. More than 1,000 buildings destroyed over the past month. The lava keeps flowing on this trip around the world on CNBC. An aspirin a day keeps the heart doctor away. That's what we thought. New research out today about why many older people prone to heart disease should not be taking low-dose aspirin each day. And are you ready for some football? In Germany, the NFL's new plan to bring the gridiron to the pitch in Europe. For the first time, the FDA is authorizing a brand of e-cigarettes. Health officials say company data shows use of e-cigarettes help people quit or significantly reduce their use of cigarettes. Today's decision only applies to Vuse refillable solar-powered device and its tobacco-flavored nicotine cartridges. In other words, it's very limited. This is part of an effort by the FDA to bring regulation to the multi-million dollar vaping industry. Take a low-dose aspirin to prevent heart attack or stroke. For years, that's what millions of Americans have been told. But new preliminary guidance says that older Americans without heart disease should not start taking an aspirin a day. The panel of experts from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force says taking an aspirin a day may cut the risk of heart disease and strokes for some adults older than 60. But for others, it could raise the risk of internal bleeding and do more harm than good. The task force also offering guidance for people ages 40 to 59, those who are at risk or a higher risk of heart disease. Experts say they should talk to their doctors before taking aspirin daily. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in America, according to the CDC. It kills more than 650,000 people each year. That's one person every 36 seconds. Dr. Harlan Krumholtz is with us now, a cardiologist and scientist at Yale University. Doctor, thanks so much. Many Americans have been taking a daily low-dose aspirin for years. Should they stop?
Well, you know, we always recommend that people should talk to their doctor before they do anything with their medications. But it's important to realize that this is draft guidance. And as you said, it's about people who are prone to heart disease, not people who have heart disease. There still remain many situations where we're really confident that aspirin provides a service to people. But these experts are coming together with this draft guidance. It's out for public comment at this point, recommending, based on their interpretation of the evidence, that people on low-dose aspirin may not be getting a benefit if they're taking it to prevent heart disease in the future, even if they're prone to heart disease.
Yeah, just a recommendation, as you rightly mentioned so far. But do you see this becoming the new rule?
Well, this group of experts has carefully studied the literature, the medical research. And over the last few years, the research has started to point us away from the value of low-dose aspirin in people prone to heart disease, again, people without heart disease. And I'm fairly confident that a lot of these recommendations, the recommendations that aspirin may not be as useful for older people, and for those in middle age, it's a bit of a toss-up and they ought to be talking to their doctors about it. I'm fairly confident that'll be the final recommendations.
Interesting. Doctor, the task force also released new guidance on diabetes screenings. They advise that adults who are obese or even overweight should start getting tested for diabetes at an earlier age. The previous recommendation was 40. Now it's 35-year-olds. Doctor, how important is this change?
Yeah, I think it's a very important change. Look, for people who are overweight or more, diabetes is something that's always lurking. It's a risk. And we want to be able to help people to reach more ideal weights and to be able to prevent diabetes. But we know many people are overweight. And this is in recognition of that and is telling us that even starting at 35, we're starting to see higher rates of diabetes, and we ought to be looking for it so we can help people with recommendations, guidance, and see if we can mitigate the potential harms.
Before we go, what is the most important thing that those of us who are a little older need to do every day to generally stay more healthy?
Yeah, I think keeping physically active is critically important. And I'd also say know your blood pressure, getting your blood pressure under control, making sure it's not elevated. Even at older ages, there's value in that. But keeping active, there's no doubt about it. That's the best thing you can do for yourself.
Doctor, thanks so much. Move over soccer. Real football is coming to Germany. The NFL reported today it plans to host regular season games at one of three cities next year, Dusseldorf, Frankfurt, or Munich. The NFL has already played games in England and Mexico. This Sunday, the Jacksonville Jaguars scheduled to face the Miami Dolphins for a game in London. Ship early or pay a premium. That's what mail carriers are warning ahead of the holiday season. Companies are cautioning everybody to get Christmas shopping done early this year, since supply chain issues and shipping backlogs have made some gifts really hard to find already. To make sure a package arrives by Christmas, which lands on a Saturday this year, the post office is now recommending you send it by December the 15th if you're using ground mail. FedEx also saying the last day to ship most ground packages is December the 15th. And UPS suggesting you ship between December 21st and 23rd if you're using three-day select. And if you procrastinate, Priority or Express options are still available for all the carriers. A famous figure in the Colorado wildlife community is finally free. Meet Tire Elk. An officer spotted Tire Elk for the first time in July of 2019. He's known for his unique neck accessory. Colorado Parks and Wildlife tried to tranquilize Tire Elk many times to free him from that tire, but he eluded their grasp. Here he is in July of last year with that same rubber necklace. And here he is again just a few weeks ago, but finally, after all this time, people fixed Tire Elk's problem on Saturday. Wildlife officials say they tranquilized him and removed that tire. Sadly, they did have to take his antlers in the process. Free of his burden, Tire Elk, now just Elk Sans Antlers. 65 seconds on a race to the finish, Gabby Petito died of manual strangulation. That from the report from the coroner in Teton County, Wyoming. He says Gabby Petito was killed 3 to 4 weeks before search teams found her body in Teton National Forest. Las Vegas Raiders head coach John Gruden resigned last night after emails surfaced which showed him making racist, homophobic, and sexist comments. Those emails part of a larger investigation into the Washington football team. And the House of Representatives has voted tonight to raise the debt limit until early December and prevent economic disaster, at least for a while. The short-term extension now heads to President Biden's desk for a signature. And now, you know the news. Of this Tuesday, October the 12th, 2021, I'm Shepard Smith. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at The News on CNBC and listen to the news podcast on Spotify or any of your favorite podcast platforms. See you back here tomorrow. You've been listening to the CNBC podcast, The News with Shepard Smith. You can always catch us live weekdays at 7 p.m. Eastern, only on CNBC.
Shining through CIDP to me means being able to do what you want to do and not what the disease is telling you you can't do. Don't give in to the disease. It's not easy, but I'm going to do it. And like I've told people, I may have CIDP, but CIDP don't have me.
Sign up at shiningthroughcidp.com to get real CIDP stories and resources.